In our new series, World War II's Greatest Battles, we chart five pivotal moments that shaped the course of the conflict with military historian James Holland. New episodes drop every Thursday on the History Extra podcast.
This episode is brought to you by Indeed. We're driven by the search for better, but when it comes to hiring, the best way to search for a candidate isn't to search at all. Don't search, match with Indeed. Use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. And listeners of this show will get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/History Extra. Just go to Indeed.com/History Extra right now and support our show by saying you heard about Indeed on this podcast. Terms and conditions apply. Need to hire? You need Indeed.
This episode is brought to you by Reese's Peanut Butter Cups. In breaking news, leading scientists worldwide are conducting experiments to determine if Reese's Peanut Butter Cups are the perfect combination of peanut butter and chocolate. However, it appears the study was inconclusive, as the scientists couldn't help but eat all the Reese's. Because when you want something sweet, you can't do better than Reese's. Find Reese's now at a store near you.
Life is a highway, and on it there will be many chicken sandwiches. But there's only one McCrispy, so go ahead and hit the turn signal if you know about this juicy gem of a detour.
Hello and welcome to the History Extra podcast from BBC History Magazine and BBC History Reveal. I'm Ellie Cawthorne. Between the 6th and 4th centuries BC, the Persians presided over the greatest empire the world had yet seen, one that encompassed swathes of Eastern Europe, North Africa, and Western Asia. So why do Western people know so little about the Persians today? It's a question that Lloyd Llewellyn Jones addresses in his new book, Persians, the Age of the Great Kings. Here, in conversation with our production editor, Spencer Mizzen, Lloyd argues it's high time we did more to tell the story of these consummate empire builders.
Well, Lloyd, thanks for joining us today.
You're very welcome. It's a pleasure to be here.
Now, Lloyd, you wrote a feature on the Persian Empire for the May issue of BBC History Magazine. And your book, which is called Persians, the Age of the Great Kings, is, I believe, in the shops now.
That's right. It's been out for about 2 weeks now, I think.
Now, in the feature, you describe the Persian Empire, which ran from roughly the middle of the 6th century BC to its fall at the hands of Alexander the Great in the second half of the 4th century BC, is the greatest the world had yet seen. Now, this was an empire presided over by some of the most accomplished rulers in ancient history, Cyrus the Great and Darius the Great among them, and one that, as you point out, at its height spanned a staggering 2 million square miles. Yeah, it's one that here in the West, at least, we know relatively little about. So I guess my first question, Lloyd, is why is that? Why have the Persian staggering achievements been so utterly overshadowed by the likes of the Greeks and the Romans in Western histories?
Well, it is because, of course, we have been so dependent in our writing of the ancient world, the history of the ancient world, on Greek and Roman sources. You know, ever since the European Enlightenment, we have allied ourselves very closely as being the heirs of Greece and Rome, and have therefore, you know, taken their historiography as our historiography too, neglecting the fact there is a global antiquity out there, you know, an antiquity that spans the whole of the continent of Asia, the whole of Africa, the whole of South America, the whole of North America. You know, it's not exactly accident of history, but it's how we have aligned ourselves to the historical narrative over the centuries. You know, we've approached the Persians from one of two sources, essentially. So first of all, they come through to us in the Hebrew Bible, that is the Christian Old Testament, where actually the Persians get really good press. You know, they were very much seen as the liberators of the Jews from the Babylonian exile, their captivity in Babylon. They were seen as the instigators of the rebuilding of the Temple of Jerusalem. So they come over, if I can use a sort of 1066 parlance, as good things. But then, of course, on the opposite side, the flip side of the coin, is the reports that we get from the Greek historians, Herodotus, Xenophon, and also, I mean, you know, comics like Aristophanes, law court speakers like Isocrates, where, of course, the Persians are cast as the ultimate enemy to the Greeks, as the ultimate barbaroi, the ultimate barbarians, essentially. So the way that they've come over in the sources is at best calculating, cold-blooded, and at worst absolute despotic and deniers of what the Greeks considered to be freedom, eleutheria in the Greek. So we are hostage to fortune, really, between these two polar opposites in which the Persians have been represented, the biblical approach and then the classical Greek and later Latin approaches as well. What I've tried to do in the book is to go back to indigenous Iranian sources, the actual Persian sources themselves, to look for what I call the Persian version, which sits behind all of these pejorative or overly glossy representations. What I don't try to do is to whitewash the Persians. You know, their empire was built by military conquest and some hard-nosed soldiers with square jaws doing some despicable things. But at the same time, I try to give the Persians their worth in terms of appearance in a global context.
There isn't time on this podcast to tell the entire story of the rise and fall of the Persian Empire. But I do wonder if you could explain how the Persians were able to preside over this enormous empire, one which stretched across vast swathes of Eastern Europe, North Africa, and Western Asia for two centuries. What were the secrets of their success?
I think more than anything else, it was an empire ruled by bureaucracy. And that's the really quite remarkable thing. It really is when bureaucrats ruled the world. The likes of Darius the Great in particular, he was exceptionally gifted as a ruler and as a very skilled bureaucrat. So he instigated, for instance, a communication system, which was second to none. And that was so fundamental to the safeguarding and the running of the empire of that size. So, for instance, the king's laws were disseminated throughout the whole empire through the use of Aramaic, for instance, as the lingua franca of the time. So rather than employing, you know, localized languages and therefore having to translate continuously, the Persians were very pragmatic in their use of Aramaic as the bureaucratic language which united the whole empire. The whole of the land empire was crisscrossed by very sophisticated road systems divided into parasangs, sort of 1.5 miles per parasang, and with road stations absolutely everywhere, meaning that somebody could travel on horseback between, say, Sardis, which is on the coast of modern-day Turkey, to the heart of Iran in about 19 days, which is pretty good going. Of course, they also mastered the seas as well, and they mastered the landscape too. Darius the Great, for instance, dug a canal from the Red Sea to the Nile, connecting these two ways, which meant that, of course, Persian ships could therefore access the Nile around the Persian Gulf and into Iran very quickly. They did the same in the north of Greece as well, dug a canal there too, which meant essentially they saw the opportunity to navigate the whole of their empires both by water and by land, which is really quite an exceptional thing. Their governance was based on what we call the satrapal system. So somewhat like governors, usually members of the imperial family, were stationed in different parts of the empire and basically ran those sections of the empire, the satrapies, on behalf of the king in the manner of the great king as well, and constantly communicated with the imperial center in the center of Iran, what was going on and so forth. The Persians demanded taxation, of course. This this usually came in the form of sort of goods more than money, although money was invented by the Persians. And at Persepolis, we see, for instance, these great ceremonial gift-giving ceremonies carved into the walls where individuals from all across the empire are seen giving the kings their bargee, their taxation, their diplomatic gifts or their diplomatic necessities, I suppose.
You write also in the feature that the Persians showed a degree of tolerance to their subject peoples. I mean, can you expand on that a little? I mean, what did that degree of tolerance actually look like?
Yes, I think this is probably the most remarkable thing about the Persians themselves. If you think of the models of ancient empires that we're used to, Rome, I suppose, comes to mind straight away. And of course, as an offshoot of that, the British, when the British had their empire, they based it very much on the Roman practice, of course. Well, in those empires, what we have, of course, is this idea that wherever you went within the realm, the imperial realm, you could see the mark of Rome or Britain. So, for instance, in its architecture, the Romans imposed their look all over their empire, just as the British did, bungalows in India and all this kind of thing. Likewise, the idea of language was really important. So in Rome, of course, in the Roman Empire, Latin had to be spoken if you were to get anywhere in the empire. And likewise, the legacy of English, of course, in India and elsewhere can still be seen today. The Persians didn't adopt any of these ideas at all. They allowed languages of nations and peoples to flourish as they had done always. And this is why they instituted Aramaic as this kind of bureaucratic language. But there was no desire at all to impose Persian on conquered peoples. And there was no desire to impose Persian traditions, that Persian look, Persian architecture, anything onto these foreign peoples. And instead, what you find is actually quite the converse happens, that the Persians were really happy to take on board other kinds of architecture or artistic trends coming from the more kind of dominant cultural spheres of their empire, Egypt, Assyria, Babylon, and assimilated them into a melange of styles which comes over as, in the end, authentically Persian. It's a very different way, of thinking about how empire could operate in antiquity and beyond. And I guess my gripe, or my sorrow, I suppose, really, is the fact that the Persian Empire wasn't taught in schools, in the mid-Victorian period, where, of course, everybody went to Roman history and as the Brits went out and, conquered, colonized, and began to build its empire, the Roman system was the way forward. At least, if we had been teaching that there was another way around empire, as unpleasant as all empires are, I'm not a fan of empire at all. Nevertheless, I do believe there would have been a more dignified way of allowing peoples to express themselves, be themselves, if we'd adopted a Persian system. And that's a lesson of historiography for us, isn't it? When we choose our sources, we have to live with the consequences.
Given all that, you describe yourself as and you kind of alluded to this earlier in the interview, you describe yourself as a revisionist, not an apologist. What exactly do you mean by that? And that kind of implies, as you've already mentioned, that the Persians could use brute force when they needed to.
Yes, that's precisely it. So I want to revise history. I want to give the Persians their place in history, but I don't want to whitewash them. And I think that's a danger, when we use words like tolerance. Well, tolerance within a certain limitations, of course, these are still imperial peoples who held on to their empire for 200 years, with force. And when peoples in the empire rebelled against the central authorities, which they did, Egypt, for instance, was a particularly thorny problem for the Persians. It broke away from the empire for almost 60 years and had to be reconquered. It was done so with brute force. The Persians were as skilled and as keen to use their military clout as any other conquering people. We see the similar kinds of attitudes taken, for instance, to mass deportation under the Persians that we see under the Assyrians and the Babylonians. The same kind of structure goes on. Artaxerxes III was notorious for being a very brutal conqueror. He razed, for instance, the city of Sidon to the ground when Sidon dared rebel against his rule. And so the Persians were not pushovers. Let's not ever think that way. And while there are many benefits to the Persian system, nevertheless, empire building, of course, goes hand in hand with military might and with a certain loss of freedoms for people. And we have to keep that in mind. I do not want to consider these peoples to have been liberators at all. They were still an oppressive lot, even though they actually governed with a more enlightened view than other ancient empires.
Still to come on the History Extra podcast.
This is something heretical to you, but sometimes I tell my students that Persepolis makes the Parthenon on the Acropolis look like a garden shed. It really does. I mean, just for the sheer sense of scale, let our listeners get that into their minds. I mean, this is imperial architecture.
This episode is brought to you by Indeed. We're driven by the search for better, but when it comes to hiring, the best way to search for a candidate isn't to search at all. Don't search. Match with Indeed. Use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. And listeners of this show will get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/History Extra. Just go to Indeed.com/History Extra right now and support our show by saying you heard about Indeed on this podcast. Terms and conditions apply. Need to hire? You need Indeed.
Life is a highway, and on it there will be many chicken sandwiches. But there's only one McCrispy, so go ahead and hit the turn signal if you know about this juicy gem of a detour.
Two Persian rulers have earned the epithet the Great, and that's Cyrus and Darius. Can you just tell us a little bit about these two men and why they deserve that title, assuming that, in fact, you think they do deserve that title?
I think they do. You know, I'm not very cavalier in using things like the great, but I think Cyrus certainly deserves it just because of the astonishing way in which, within his lifetime, he went from taking Iran from being basically a tribal federation to the beginnings of imperialism. It was quite astonishing, really. Within 40 years, he had managed to conquer all of the Persian tribes, conquer the Medes in the north, and bring under his control their ever-increasing empire, which took him into central Anatolia, brought crashing down the kingdom of Lydia, and therefore brought the Persians into contact with the Greek city-states for the first time, and, of all things, managed to conquer Babylon and bring in under his control the whole of the Neo-Babylonian Empire as well. I mean, this is staggering, really, really astonishing. And I can't, you know, it's really hard to put it down. What was it? I mean, this man just had vision and just incredible self-awareness, I suppose, to have done that and to brought these people with him, you know. From really being nomads to imperial builders within 40 years is incredible. Darius, I guess, does deserve the epithet, the great, but for a different reason. I think he, as I said, was the great bureaucrat. He was the controller and the organizer. I think his great skill was bringing the empire a coherency, a kind of ideology of monarchy was established under him. the actual, we get our first Persian, ancient Persian language inscriptions under him as well. So he was promoting the empire, I suppose, finding a rationale for his empire. He didn't have a great deal of success military-wise. There was an aborted campaign into Scythia. We know there was trouble on the Western Front with the Greeks and the Ionians. One thing he did do, and it's a shame really that the Ionian Greeks got in the way, he had a campaign into India, and of course he conquered up into the Punjab, but he could have gone much deeper into India if he hadn't had to draw his forces back into Anatolia to put down the Greek rebellions that were going on there. So that was his great missed opportunity. But by and large, his greatness relies in his bureaucracy and in his vision for giving the empire itself a kind of a message, I suppose, an ideology to get behind.
I guess we can't mention Darius without talking about his extraordinary palace, Persepolis, in the desert of modern-day Iran. You describe this as one of the great sites of antiquity. What makes it so incredible?
It's sheer scale. You know, when you wander around the ruins of Persepolis, they have a really haunting quality to them. They're very beautiful, but it really is architecture on an imperial scale. You know, I've taken my students to Iran several times, and many of them have visited Athens, been up on the Acropolis before, and they make the point to me all the time that this is on a different level entirely. It really is. This is something heretical to you, but sometimes I tell my students that Persepolis makes the Parthenon on the Acropolis look like a garden shed. It really does. I mean, just for the sheer sense of scale, let our listeners get that into their minds. I mean, this is imperial architecture. It is palace after palace. Essentially, the whole of Persepolis was a building site for over 200 years, as every successive king added their own buildings onto the imperial platform. The great Apadana, the great imperial throne hall at Persepolis, can hold 100,000 people, wow, for instance. You know, yeah. I mean, that's the kind of scale that we're dealing with.
That's a lot of people.
It's a lot of people. It's a vast, vast enterprise.
Can we return to the Greeks? I want to know, why were they so keen to trash the Persians? I mean, what was in it for them?
What was in it for them was actually the birth of a sense of their own identity. You know, before the Persian Wars, there was no such thing as Greece, of course. There were city-states united by a language with its various dialects, but there was no real sense of being Hellenes together at all. This is why, I suppose, the myth of Troy was so important to them. At least it gave them some kind of galvanizing unity. When the Persians emerged as this huge superpower in the East, and we shouldn't underestimate the roller coaster impact it had on the Greeks, it forced the Greeks to come together to repel this enemy, and it gave them a sense of purpose and a sense of identity. It never unified the Greeks per se. Don't forget, within 30 years of the Persian Wars, we're into the period of the Peloponnesian Wars, and even during the Persian Wars itself, I think it's very important to remember, and I've stressed this in my book, that this was not a united Greek front against Persia. There were many Greek city-states who fought for the Persians, who really believed that their future, the betterment of their people, lay with the Persian Empire than being alone, having to defend themselves against other warring and hostile Greek city-states. But what happens is, of course, is that over the centuries, by the time, or well, even very close on, by the time we get to Herodotus, writing some 60 years after Xerxes' invasion, we have a mythologizing process already at work. You know, Herodotus has got a very clear agenda. That is, he's writing an inquiry into the wars for an Athenian audience. That's his base. And so what he tries to do in the histories, of course, is to create a mythology, a series of legends, in a way, in which Athens itself takes prime place. It's the major player. And, of course, has to set itself up as a kind of mirror image against the despicable, despotic Persians. What's incredible is the legacy that historical approach has had on Western historians ever since. So in the 19th century, John Stuart Mill was able to write, for instance, and this is really incredible. He once said, as an episode in British history, the Battle of Marathon is more important than the Battle of Hastings. That's really quite remarkable.
That is quite a statement, yeah.
Because there he's saying, of course, you know, that what we are as Europeans, as Westerners, we owe everything to the Greeks. And therefore, this moment when, you know, the Persians were repelled first at Marathon and later on at Salamis in particular, was really the founding moment, the cornerstone of Western civilization. And that is, you know, that's still a factoid which is distributed widely today. I noticed that a book has recently come out called something like The Three Battles That Saved the West, or something like that, you know, or Saved Democracy, whatever democracy was, you know, in its ancient form. I do speculate in the book what would have happened had the Greeks succumbed to Persian power. I think that there's very a little prospect of the Persians having destroyed this nascent democracy. After all, many of the Greek cities in Asia Minor, which were ruled by Persians, still continued as democracies because the Persians just didn't change the, you know, the institutions of the cities that they conquered anywhere in their empire. So I think that highly likely that Athens would have become a satrapal centre for the rulership of Greece. But what would have happened, I think, is that from there, the Persians and their many Greek allies, including Athens then, of course, it would have been, would have stormed into the Peloponnese and would have destroyed the Spartans, who were really actually the true despots of antiquity, of course. You know, I mean, there are no, you know, worse kind of rulership than under Sparta. So it would have been a very different political look. But I don't think that the Persians would ever have destroyed the fledgling democracy. There would still have been drama. There would still have been sculpture. You know, I do not believe that, as some people have said, you know, in their scaremongering, that we wouldn't have emerged as a civilization had the Persians got there first. Whatever have happened, it's simply not the Persian way.
But how much is this Greek hatchet job or retarded or obstructed research into the Persians in the West over the centuries?
Well, it's there all the time, you know. I mean, it's constantly being written and rewritten. It has informed our own British idea of what empire is all about. Lord Curzon, Viceroy of India, had travelled to Persia in the 1880s. He'd written his two-volume work on Persia, which some people have said was the world's largest CV. Basically, the job was, you know, Viceroy of India, which he got, of course. And in it, you know, he kind of comes to Persia with all of his kind of preconceived knowledge that he gets from Herodotus and from Xenophon. And he makes statements like, it seems puzzling to me, he says, that the Asiatic would rather be ruled piecemeal by other Asiatics than brought under the civilizing banner of Europe. You know, I mean, that's the legacy that we're dealing with, or, you know, constantly. And it goes through, of course, into popular culture. I mean, you've only got to think of the film like 300 or its prequel 300 Rise of an Empire to see that the same rhetoric is being tropped out time after time after time. It's an old and a hackneyed way of looking at the Greek and Persian past. And this is why, really, I decided to write the book after years and years and years of teaching Persian history to students in Edinburgh University and laterally in Cardiff University. I thought, you know, this needs to get out there further, because we have to start looking at antiquity in a global context to really understand what's going on. You know, we have to join up all the dots. We can't remain a kind of Eurocentric little island any longer. We're not doing that with the rest of the world and with other, you know, later periods in history. There is a drive towards a globalized look at what's going on, and we can do that in ancient history as well. And so this book is part of a call, which others are making too, to extend our knowledge, to spread our understanding, and to look at ancient history in a kind of cinemascope way, really, you know, in widescreen format, and see where we can draw ideas together.
I mean, on that note, what about the rest of the world? Are the Persians' achievements celebrated more widely outside Europe? And obviously, I'm thinking most especially here about in Iran itself.
Iran has got a very problematic and mixed attitude to its pre-Islamic past. So let's not forget that Iran is at least on paper, a theocracy. So it's the Islamic Republic of Iran, don't forget. And therefore, how the pre-Islamic past is preserved and represented in Iran does have its problems. So the ruling regime is not comfortable, particularly, of course, with the acknowledgement that there was a pagan past in Iran. And yet, at the same time, it is very aware that most Iranians are patriotic and nationalistically drawn to the glories of the Persian Empire. Of course they should be, you know, to figures like Cyrus the Great and Darius the Great. They are naturally drawn to them, but they don't know what to do with it. That's the trouble. So ancient Persian history is not well taught in Iran at all. One of my students many years ago, an Iranian girl herself, did a survey at Persepolis on tourists, local Iranian tourists who were turning up. And she was just asking very basic questions. Who built this? When was it built? And that nobody could really answer, you know. So there's, by and large, a lack of understanding of Persia's own past. And yet, at the same time, there is this drive, especially by the young, to claim its antique heritage as part of what's happening there now. The demography of Iran is remarkable. Over 70% of Iranians are under the age of 40, which is it's a very, very young country full of young people. And these young people are media savvy. They're on social networking all the time. They are very aware of the way in which their country is misrepresented by Western media, and they are using their very rich pre-Islamic heritage as a counterlever to that. They're saying, look, we were sophisticated, we were world leaders at one time. And while there may be a tendency to gild the lily or to look at these things through rose-coloured glasses on the Iranian part, which I hope my book will kind of address for them, I do not want to take away that sense of pride that they have in their past. I think they've earned it. I think it's owing to them, really. So I'm happy for them to keep on doing that, and long may they do it as well. I'm glad to say that increasingly, more and more scholarly books on ancient Persia are being translated into Farsi and are appearing in the bookshops of Iran. And there's clearly an appetite for them. I'm hoping that my book will get a Farsi translation. My other works have had translations into Farsi, which I think is really important. But, what I long to see is more Iranians writing their own history from the inside. That's what's important, of course. That's what we need to be striving for. That's when we know that the job is done, when people take hold of their own histories and write their own national narratives, of course. So that's what I hope we can look for in the future.
You know, in your feature, that part of the, not necessarily problem, but maybe one of the difficulties in writing histories of the Persians is the way that they wrote history themselves. So they chiefly relied on oral storytelling, poetry, and song. I mean, how much of a problem does the nature of the sources present to historians of the Persian Empire?
Well, yes, there is no one narrative history of the Persians. You know, they didn't have their Herodotus and they didn't have their Xenophon. It was of no interest to them. These were a nomadic people who took their stories, their histories with them. And yes, they remembered them very differently. It's not that the Iranians don't know the history, it's that they remember it differently. That's the key here. So when you're an ancient Persian historian, you have to cast your net very wide. You have to go and look at everything. That means royal inscriptions, the kind of official and therefore very hyperbolic texts set up by the great kings themselves. You have to look at all of the cuneiform documents, which exist in their tens of thousands, which tell us about the bureaucracy of the empire, how Persepolis and Susa ran. You have to look at the art. You have to look at the archaeology. You have to think about things from the point of view of an anthropologist, how you know societies work on the ground. You cannot throw out anything. You have to use everything. So Persian history, really, working on Persian history is like putting together a huge jigsaw puzzle. And there are many, many gaps in our knowledge from around the edge. And a couple of pieces, our core pieces, are missing from the center as well. But, you know, there's always hope that we will find more to make that picture more complete. We just have to think differently when we're approaching Persian history as modern historians.
And what do you think the future holds for the study of the Persian Empire?
I think things look good. You know, from my own experience of teaching it for 20 years now, it certainly grips the students' imagination. They very often come to universities only knowing some Greek and Roman history. And so Persian history comes as something as a surprise and a novelty to them. Once they taste it, it tends to stay with them as well. So increasingly, myself and colleagues are supervising PhDs in Persian history and so forth. I'm delighted to say that GCSE Ancient History now has compulsory ancient Persian component, and that we're working very hard at the moment about putting in an ancient Persian component into A-level ancient history as well. So we are normalizing the Persians. That's all I want. I don't want to privilege the Persians over anybody else. I just want them to have their own place in our understanding of how ancient cultures and ancient societies work together. I think there's a great deal of scope. There's a lot to be done yet. You know, when we compare it with historians of Greece or historians of Egypt, who have been writing histories of their cultures for centuries now, we're a long way behind. So there are many, many areas that are as yet unexplored. There are many different thematic approaches we can take to Persia. So, for instance, it would be great to see some work done on gender in ancient Persia, ethnicity in ancient Persia, all of these kind of buzz topics which are routinely looked at now by ancient historians in the fields of Rome, Greece and Egypt and others. All of this is open and ripe for investigation within Persia as well. So I'm really hoping, and I'm very hopeful, in fact, that there's a secure future for Persia ahead.
And finally, Lloyd, with our listeners in mind, if they wanted to go and experience some of the treasures of Persia, to go to a museum and see some of these incredible cultural creations and artefacts, I mean, where should they be going?
Well, there are a couple I can recommend. First of all, of course, in London, there's the British Museum itself, which has got a small but very, very fine collection of ancient Persian artefacts, including the famous Oxus treasure. A quick nip across the channel will take you to the Louvre in Paris. And the Louvre has got an unsurpassed collection of ancient Persian antiquities, mainly drawn from the French excavations at Susa during the late 19th century, really quite a staggering collection. The Pergamon Museum in Berlin also has a very, very fine collection in its permanent collection. But I should give a bit of a plug as well that next year at the British Museum, running from April until August next year, 2023, the British Museum are hosting a huge exhibition called Luxury from Cyrus to Alexander, which deals on the Persian court and the Persian Empire. So that'll be a bit of a visual treat, I've no doubt whatsoever.
That was Lloyd Llewellyn Jones. His book, Persians, the Age of the Great Kings, is out now, published by Wildfire. Lloyd also wrote a feature on the Persians for the May issue of BBC History magazine. You can find that now at historyextra.com. Just search for The Persians. Thanks for listening. This podcast was produced by Jack Bateman.